You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank NA, member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count for your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by legendary actor Willem Dafoe. I sat with him back in 2017 around the release of Sean Baker's The Florida Project, for which he received an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor. In the 6 years since then, Dafoe has kept remarkably busy. He was nominated again in 2019 for his portrayal of Vincent Van Gogh in At Eternity's Gate. He also made two films with Robert Eggers, The Lighthouse and The Northman, and two films with Wes Anderson, The French Dispatch and Asteroid City, not to mention Guillermo del Toro's Nightmare Alley and Paul Schrader's The Card Counter. And those are just my personal favorites of his in recent years. His latest, however, is a film called Poor Things, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. In it, Dafoe plays Dr. Godwin Baxter, a daring scientist who brings a young woman back to life through a rather unorthodox experiment. Once she's reborn, Bella, played by Emma Stone, embarks on a kind of voyage of sexual liberation. Here's a clip from the trailer.
This is Bella. Bella, this is Mr. McCandles.
Hello, Bella.
Oh, she's an experiment.
Good evening.
Her brain and her body are not quite synchronized. But she's progressing at an accelerated pace.
Tell me, where did she come from?
I shall. For it is a happy tale.
I am Bella Baxter, and there is a world to enjoy, circumnavigate.
It is the goal of all to progress, grow.
A woman plotting her course to freedom. How delightful.
That was from the new film Poor Things, now in limited release across the country. To check for showings in your area, visit poorthingsfilm.com. The movie is exclusively playing in theaters at the moment and is really one of those that, if you can, you should venture out to see. Lanthimos has made other rich, dark comedies like The Lobster and The Favorite, but Poor Things is unlike anything I've ever seen. It's a coming-of-age story, dystopian, Merchant Ivory film, and then ultimately a sort of inversion of the Frankenstein story. Defoe, who's in the role of the father, ends up becoming this strange, beating heart of the movie. It's also a deceptively moving performance, more tender and warm than the characters you probably know him from in films like To Live and Die in L.A., Platoon, Wild at Heart, the list goes on, many of which we discuss in this conversation. We also talk about his early love of B-movies, why this role as a doctor is an especially personal one, his formative years as part of the Wooster Group, and the guiding principles that have shaped a lifetime of brilliant performances. That's all coming up next with our guest, Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe.
Yes, hi.
Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
How are you feeling?
I feel good. I haven't been in LA lately, so it's nice to be back.
Oh, yeah. Is that a good thing, not being here?
No, I'm happy when I'm here. I've never really lived here. I've lived here for periods of time doing movies, so I'm usually happy because I'm working, I'm doing something that I like. Also, L.A., I see friends that I don't normally see. You know, I put up with the car stuff.
You want to travel by foot or by train?
Yes.
Why don't we start with this new movie of yours?
Sounds good.
It's called Poor Things. It's directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, and in it, you play a lonely scientist with a disfigured face.
Yes.
Whose latest experiment finds him reanimating a 30-something corpse played by Emma Stone by replacing her defunct brain with that of an unborn child.
Her unborn child.
You're spoiling it, not me.
It's a good detail.
Yeah, it's a good detail. No, it's a good detail.
Did I do?
But I was going to say, as I explain that movie.
It's sort of important that.
It is important. I just felt like it comes later. I don't know. We can litigate this.
Yeah. You know, I'm not one of those people.
I know. No, neither am I.
My wife is always, don't tell me, even when I'm working on a movie. I don't want to know a thing. I just want to see the movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't get it. I can watch a movie kind of knowing what happens because I can will my brain to forget where we're going and try to be with each scene.
Suspension of disbelief, I think
it is.
There
we go.
Yeah. That's the basic premise of the film. How would you describe the world of the project, the world that you inhabited as a character and an actor?
Well, it's a imagined Victorian world, and it's got all these kind of steampunk elements. You know, there's these advancements in science that are kind of fantastical next to things of that period. So it's a playful reimagining or imagining of Victorian time that never was. So you're leaning into Victoriana, but you're also spinning. So the world is very specific. It's so beautifully designed and so complete that as an actor, you enter that world and it really tells you what to do because there's nothing like it. So your responses to it, of course, in tandem with the script, really are very clear. There's a kind of reality in the fantasy that's the kind of place as an actor that I enjoy being.
On set, you would often walk around what they had built, right? I mean, what would
it's
that look like?
Just the nature of, I like to hang out on the set just to know what's going on. And it's a special time, you know? You get to be there, watch the other people, see what's going on. Also, it's a way to relax into being there. And the set was fantastic and had the degree of detail to go for a walk in there and just poke around, go into the library, open up books, you know, check out some of the weird objects. That was a wealth of information for me.
Yeah, what did you find while walking around?
You know, the crazy thing is there would be a whole bookshelf and I would randomly pull out a book and inside would be legit surgical diagrams and things specific to our story.
This is beyond the typical prop work.
Oh, yes. I love my props.
A level of detail.
A level of detail. You know, and at the same time, it wasn't precious, you know?
Right.
We weren't, I don't know, it just helps you a great deal, and it's not shown off. It was just the pleasure of making those things. I think the production people, the design people just kind of enjoyed it, and Yorgos probably gently let them go, you know, and worked with them on it.
I know philosophically you don't believe that one transforms into the character.
I'm not sure that's true.
You think that's wrong?
No, tell
well,
me more.
Because the
tell
quote I have for you is people often ask you, how did you transform into the character?
Mm-hmm.
And your response often is, the character is already in me.
Yeah.
It's lived in me.
Okay.
It's not a kind of metamorphosis that happens.
Well, that is a metamorphosis because that's not what you're showing and that's not necessarily what you're concentrating on. So there is a transformation because you're taking another shape.
Right.
You're presenting or you're living a different aspect of you that doesn't get exercised. The idea being that the character is born of situations, a series of reactions and living that the character appears. So okay, I suppose that's a transformation.
Yes.
But the fact that it's within you, just like it's within you.
That seems like a key distinction, though.
Maybe it is. Because I find more and more it's important to get away from this notion of ownership of an identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of saying, oh, all characters are within us, then you don't have everything relative to who you think you are. It's kind of open.
Mm-hmm.
And you accept, just like I say, you have those characters in you too, and they would emerge given the right circumstances. You're not practiced at it, and that's not your job, so that's not going to happen. But the possibility is there. We're thinking broad strokes, like, you know, we're all brothers and sisters, broad strokes. You know?
We're diving into philosophy about 30 minutes before I thought we would. But
okay.
But I love it. I love it. We're talking in the morning. I'm here for it. I'm here for it. In this case, the actual physical transformation that you had to undergo, I wonder, you're playing a doctor who works on people. But in order to play that part, you yourself had to be worked on for hours and hours and hours.
Yes.
How did that shape your approach to the character in this story?
In the story, once again, you correct me because I'm not that sensitive to spoilers.
I don't make it a habit to correct my guests.
Okay, and you can do. I'm inviting you.
Especially not Willem Dafoe.
I'm inviting you, please. my father, his backstory, if you will, used me for experiments. And also introduced me to this world of objective science. And it had a horrible effect on me. Not only am I disfigured.
Literal scars.
There's certain things that I'm unable to do physically, and I need help with my digestion. I'm basically impotent because he's operated on my genitals. He handed me a pretty bad hand. Okay?
You're smiling as you're saying this.
Well, the beauty, he turns his pain into a certain devotion towards science.
Something positive.
And it always disturbs me when people describe him as a mad scientist because he's really quite compassionate and quite on top of it in the sense that he's handed a really bad hand and he plays it well. But getting back to his makeup, to be in the chair for a long period of time, you know, actors love to complain about their process and look all brave and dedicated by how difficult it is. But actually,
that was my next question. How brave are you?
Actually, it's a pleasure. It's difficult to do, but then you sit in the chair and you start to recede as they put these pieces on you. They glue them to your face. You can't sleep because you have to cooperate with them because some of the pieces are quite intricate and delicate. And you sit there for a long time looking at yourself, at least superficially, go away. And something else emerges. And that really is a beautiful preparation to say, guess what? Willem went bye-bye. We're trying to, you know, inhabit this other thing under these circumstances. Mm-hmm. So it's a good preparation. By the time everyone else gets there and you're ready to shoot, you're in the groove, hopefully.
You know, when it comes to your makeup, this is an especially personal role for you, in part because your father was a doctor for 40 years. He worked out of this industrial paper mill town in Appleton, Wisconsin, where your mother also worked alongside with him as a nurse. But my understanding is that this clinic was at the center of a pretty agricultural community where patients would come from all over the place.
Very far away.
They travel great distances to see him, which you saw firsthand working as a janitor there.
Right.
I wondered, what did you make of the relationship between the patients and your parents?
It's funny. My mother, she worked as a nurse, and she'd also work in the lab, and she did all kinds of things. She was the original super mother. She had 8 children, and she worked all during that time. I was basically brought up by my older sisters. But when I was a janitor, and sometimes I was around, these people that came from very far away would be sitting in the waiting room, and my father, who was basically an intestinal surgeon, but also did many things, you know, was basically functioning as a GP, would get called out for surgery, emergency surgery. Mm. So all these people would have to wait.
Oof.
And my mother would kind of deal with them, and they'd cuss her out, and they'd be angry and treat her horribly because, you know, some dairy farmer that never leaves his farm goes into the big city of 50,000 one day and sits around for 10 hours waiting for the doctor to appear. And then my father would breeze in at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and he'd want to see patients. And they'd see him, and they were like, oh, doctor, and they'd give my mother a dirty look. So that really informed a lot of my relationships. It gave me a lot of information about how different people in different positions are treated and, gender roles and that sort of thing.
That's what I want to ask you about, actually, because I read about this, and what you're describing is a gap and a difference in distance in behavior from one person to the next. They treated your father like the hero who came down from God knows where, and your mother
as that horrible woman that's making them wait.
Exactly. What did that tell you about people?
That they, you know, it's back to poor things, you know. It really shows how they're socially conditioned, and when they get squeezed, when they don't feel comfortable, they go to those kind of attitudes and kind of stereotypes and kind of ways. They aren't thinking. They're in panic mode. They're in frustrated mode.
Right.
And they sort of adopt these righteous positions without thinking about them. So one thing about poor things is it has a lot to do with identity and social conditioning. And the beauty is that this main character, beautifully played by Emma Stone, she's not just a person without a filter. She's basically a child in a woman's body who hasn't been conditioned socially. So she doesn't have a filter, but it doesn't come out of some kind of stance. It's just, it's not her experience. And she sees very clearly. So she's kind of like the wise one and the innocent at the same time.
You called it a spin on Frankenstein.
Well, that's the setup.
Right.
That's the setup. But it's quite different when you think Frankenstein, the doctor put a criminal's brain into this creature. This is different.
But the way it's upending our ideas around gender and possession, I think, is fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's the heart of it. And, you know, much is made of the sexuality because that's the entertaining part. And it does have a lot to do with poking holes and kind of our puritanical sometimes stances on what is correct or incorrect behavior in terms of expression of sexuality or sexual experience.
It's funny because your upbringing, you alluded to this, but you have 5 sisters that I think were pretty responsible for raising you and shaping probably some of your ideas around the stuff that we're talking about.
Very much.
Your parents worked together. They were workaholics. You always described them as such.
Yeah.
I'm curious because I want to go back to your dad for a moment. Mm-hmm. Growing up, he would make these trips to Chicago.
Right. With my mother, I think they were romantic getaways.
To get away from the eight children?
Yeah, yeah, and the work.
Yeah. Yeah. And when they returned, it's my understanding that he would come back with these Super 8 films that you would watch together, one of which was Frankenstein and these monster movies.
Yes.
What was that like?
I wouldn't watch them so much with him. He'd really give them as presents.
Okay. He said, get away from me. You go watch them.
No, no. He was cool. But like I say, he was a workaholic. So we didn't spend that much time together. But that was great. And we had a little Bell and Howell projector. And we'd show them over and over again. And I loved, you know, there was a little lever where you could slow motion it and go backwards. And I remember particularly I was struck by the moment in Bride of Frankenstein where he reaches for the lever and says, "We belong dead," and a single tear goes down his face, and then he pulls the lever that destroys everything.
"Look out! The lever! Get away from that lever! You'll blow us all to atoms!"
"You stay. We belong dead.
Even as a child, I thought, wow.
That
speaks volumes to me. But, you know, going back to my sisters, I mean, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but that was very important. You know, my brothers and myself, we were burdened by this kind of role.
What role?
By a role to follow in my father's footsteps and to be successful. And that was available to us because we were white middle-class men. Mm-hmm. My sisters, you know, the big thing was to make sure that they got an education and not get pregnant, you know? And I saw that because there was less pressure on them, they were able to develop in much stronger ways than we were because we developed an eye of seeing ourselves in the outside world. And they weren't afforded that because they were shut out of a lot of those opportunities.
Right.
So I've always kind of thought, oh, how cool to be a girl. I mean, I'm happy I'm a guy, but
that's going to be the title of the episode now. In this house, you said once there was a terrific distaste for introspection and reflection. That was selfish, you said. You're supposed to go forward, to produce, to make your mark, and I have that in my blood. As a kid, then a teenager, you know, in this town of 50,000, what did making your mark look like to you? What did you think of that?
I think it was about being successful, being admired, being able to take care of yourself. There was a kind of self-reliant, you know, don't depend on anyone. It's all about the individual, where much later in life, I shifted more towards, not much later in life. I mean, my life has always been about
the collective.
Collaboration and the collective. But the truth is, what I said, the quote that you said, is true. But then there was the flip side of that, that we were children left alone because both my parents worked. Probably not at the beginning so much. I'm at the bottom half of the family. But we used to do crazy things and make everything a game. And I think that had a huge influence on me, this idea of a group of people making something. If we had to clean the house, we'd make it a game. And someone would officiate and, you know, we'd get a play-by-play.
You'd have a referee.
Like that. I say it now and it's kind of embarrassing.
No, it's great.
Silly stuff. But there was a great sense of play and a great sense of collaboration and the idea of fantasy and play was very important to getting stuff done.
You were big on pranks back then, weren't you?
I was. Boy, you're really hitting me hard on the childhood stuff.
Oh, it's hard. I have a bunch of things where you enjoyed fake vomit.
Yeah, yeah.
You dressed up as an ape and protested the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
These are hard-hitting things right here.
Well, they're hard-hitting when you consider I'm a man of a certain age and we're talking about this stuff. I mean, it's memorable and it was fun. And still, I think that sense of play is important.
I think so. I actually think it is worth noting because of your love of performance art. To me, that it starts there.
I was reminded that I was doing an interview actually earlier today about a collaboration I did with Marina Abramovich.
My favorite.
And the guy was asking very much about what were things we had in common, you know? And I said, well, in some ways, we have a lot that we're not in common. But I did recall when I was a child, when the astronauts were going up, that really caught my, you know, going up to the moon. Mm-hmm. And the astronaut thing was very strong for me. So I remember wondering, could I do that? Could I be that? And I used to lock myself in a closet to see if I could stand to be by myself for long periods of time, which feels a little bit like something has something in relationship to the impulse that Marina has when she was doing some of her earlier work.
Could you?
You know, I tried.
A couple days?
I guess that's the important thing. No, I didn't even make it a day. You know, you'd leave to pee and that sort of thing.
You're like, oh, you know what? I'm hearing some noise
I'm
out there.
I'm getting hungry.
Did someone call my name? Hold on, I got to go out.
No, I was, what I'm bragging about is the impulse.
I know.
Not about the result in this case.
That's right. And the impulse is a good indicator of what was to come, I think.
Well, it's just this idea that turned on to create a circumstance where you can find out about yourself and
right.
about your almost existential questions, even as a kid, you know, to try to give some kind of shape to your experience. And sometimes you have to do things to pin down exactly how you feel.
Mm. You said once in an old magazine that doesn't exist anymore called Dramalogue, you said, this is pathetically romantic, but when I was younger, I think I was profoundly disappointed by the world, and I felt like an outsider, and that led me to things outside my family. Did life outside your family begin with Theater X, you know, this acting group that you joined in college?
Even before. Yeah, I think in the sense that in this collaboration and in making theater pieces and being an actor, being in a group of people mm-hmm. with a project, applying themselves, coming together, and then doing something publicly, that started quite early when I was even younger, even before I was out of the house, I think, seeking that community. And I found that in community theater and shows at school, that sort of thing. But the truth is, you know, I didn't really know people that were actors or made their living being artists of any kind, so it wasn't a realistic career goal. And then you put that next to that kind of striving, you got to produce kind of attitude that I grew up mm-hmm. with. And they were at war. And I think basically, I never decided, and I'm really struck that I went towards situations and people and never really decided to be an actor, but the situations and people kind of compounded the situation. And after a while, I looked around and I said, well, I guess I'm an actor because I'm not doing anything else. That's not to say that I didn't try to train. I went to school very briefly, but I was too eager to perform. I was too eager to be out in the world and to not be in the hothouse of, you know, being in a university theater department.
So you went towards New York City.
Then I got called back a little bit by Theater X and went touring with them. And that was a big eye-opener because we got picked up by a Dutch producer that brought us to a tour in Europe. And what was significant about that is there was one place in particular in Amsterdam called the Mickery Theater. And they were very well-funded at that time. The director of that theater basically went around the world and cherry-picked things that he liked as far as theater, usually avant-garde stuff. And I was there watching this stuff, some of the best companies in the world, some of the most radical theater in the world. And that had a profound effect on me because it was inspiring.
What did that look like?
You know, it was more influenced by event and spectacle and also less by, you know, literature and psychology, more by dance, performance, visual art, mixed media, those sorts of things.
In New York in 76, 77, when you first discovered the performance group,
right,
which would then turn into the Wooster group.
Yeah.
You called it, kind of what you're saying now, you called it a laboratory.
Right.
They were publicly creating these opportunities for their own personal liberation. So I have two questions on this.
Liberation, I'm reaching. I mean, I think that's true, but that's not what we were thinking of. We were young kids. that were just attracted to people and having fun. And
so that younger Willem with that quote, that was a reach. That was a reach for him.
Liberation?
No, that was you, not me.
No, I said that probably. That was the old Willem talking about the young woman, Willem, incorrectly.
You said woman, which I think was a Freudian slip.
I got women on my mind.
Is that always true?
No. I'm talking about poor things.
So liberation is a reach.
I mean, what I want to paint is you're downtown and there are all these people that are coming, they're practicing stuff that they haven't been trained
right.
at. I think that's true. And that was quite remarkable, you know, and there are examples. You can go back to people like David Byrne went to RISD, but what did he end up doing? Making music. It was all mixed up. And there was a community of people. My former partner, Elizabeth LeCompte, the director of the Wooster Group, used to always say, we're a community theater. And that would bother me because I think, well, that means we're not professional, you know? And she said, no, we're a community theater and our community is Soho. And at that time, Soho was full of a lot of
life
and activity. And that's really, it's hard to measure, but really the art. The art world started to boom, and with it a certain kind of boom in non-traditional theater. We weren't careerists trying to go towards something. We were doing something for now.
I would say careerist and Wooster Group, I don't think those two have ever been in the same sentence
it's
together.
True. It's kind of a miracle they still exist.
The word that does come up often, and I think it's a description you don't particularly like.
Uh-oh, we're going to fight?
Oh, no, because I'm in agreement with you. But in the press, the Wooster Group is often described as a kind of deconstruction
right.
of theater and performance.
Right.
But I know you have often found that description to be kind of contradictory. Why is that?
Because it feels, you know, that sounds like a postmodern, heady kind of thing.
Right.
That just wasn't my experience. We were playing around. We were doing things that interested us. We were taking plays that we were interested in and sometimes cutting them up, doing our favorite parts because we were using it kind of iconographically in a larger sense. We were using pieces of the culture to construct not necessarily a narrative, but let's say a collage of our experience and mm-hmm. our interests. So that's a little different than this kind of
deconstruction.
Maybe it's accurate. I don't know. But the point is, it sounded very heady and very like we had a mission and we had this postmodern idea where it was more direct than that and more essential than that and more practical than that. For example, we worked with a lot of home video equipment before people were integrating video projections and that kind of stuff into theater work. It wasn't a grand idea. It was a solution, you know? It's like we had an idea.
What do you mean by that? It was a solution.
Well, here's a good example. We were doing a production of Three Sisters, Chekhov's Three Sisters, and the sisters were quite elderly. We cast up. There was one servant role that was played by Steve Buscemi's grandmother. And I think she was like 90 or something like that. Well, she couldn't be there. So we put her on video and we'd wheel out a television and we'd play the scenes with her. That sounds like, some heady thing, but it was practical.
It was a means to an end.
She would say her lines. There would be space involved left so we could interact with her. And it became a score. It became a dance.
Mm, I like that. I think that the reason I bring it up is because deconstruction seems to imply that it's boiled down to something, that there is a desired effect. And you've often said, we didn't know where we were going.
That's true.
There's a malleability that you wanted to keep. And I think that definition makes it sound like there's a fixed outcome.
Right. Well, particularly me, as an actor, I always feel a little irresponsible because I truly don't know what stuff means. But that's not important in my role. As long as my engagement, my level of engagement, my presence in doing what I do is fully committed.
Mm.
It's called a leap of faith. You're really diving into something that you don't exactly know. But the quality of going towards that thing is what's important, I think. Because if you know exactly where you're going, you tend to race to it somewhere and then craft kind of a trip.
It's mapped but not lived.
It's mapped but not lived. Thank you. That's good. And steal that.
You apparently have to do the Dax Shepard podcast. So if you just want to take that with you, just make sure you quote me on it, okay?
I think it'll be a hell of a lot different.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'll take that as a compliment.
Are you guys in competition with each other?
There's no competition between us. He's a famous movie star and I'm 29.
You're 29?
That's right.
Young man.
You were alluding to those great directors that you've worked with mm-hmm. and how you take a leap of faith with them. I want to talk about those in a second, but the mm-hmm. one thing, before you jump into the movies, mm-hmm. this thing that we're kind of circling, the way in which you developed your craft, there's an essay in the Drama Review from 1985 called Task and Vision. Mm-hmm. Task and Vision, Vision in the Form of a Task. Can you explain to me what that means to you and how it is kind of foundational to how you approach this work?
For your audience, I'll make it real simple.
Great, because we're Philistines.
No, for me, I'll make it real simple. I think that was very much about the idea of everything is based on doing as opposed to showing. Mm-hmm. One of the beautiful things about the Wooster Group, which really put a heavy stamp on me and really created, while I don't have a fixed way of approaching things, I have tendencies that I recognize. And in that theater, the technicians were as important as the actors, and the actors were as important as the technicians, and sometimes they shared tasks. And the truth was, they weren't all that different. Mm-hmm. I also think you experience that in something like the Florida Project, where, you know, the professional actor learns from the person that's not an actor. It's about having an experience, have something happen to you that's transparent enough that the audience can be with you and hopefully can have something, a mm-hmm. flavor of that experience.
Right.
And it can broaden how we think, or it can give us other possibilities. I mean, that's the idea. Rather than telling us something that we already know or we recognize, put us in a place where you say, it's what I like going to the movies for. It's like, wow, I never thought of it that way. Or, wow, I've got to learn to be less this and more mm-hmm. like that, because you see an example of some personal generosity or heroism or something, and it inspires you. That's what you want to get. It's about, in real time, giving yourself to something that expresses a more collective experience.
After the break, more from Willem Dafoe.
I've interviewed many successful people over the years, and one thing I find fascinating is that many of them don't consider themselves business savvy. Take the owners of Tight Knit Brewing. They turn to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards, and do all of it in one place with the Chase mobile app. And that's helped these brew-loving friends turn a passion into a business. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away,
there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarsella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive bonus content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
Coming back, I want to talk about the things that have happened to you by way of some of these films. We can't possibly talk about all of them because life is short and you have things to do. But I want to highlight some that are particularly important to me.
Okay.
The first one is To Live and Die in L.A. It's directed by the late William Friedkin. Rest in peace. We started this conversation talking about the world of Poor Things and the vision of Yorgos. I thought we should probably use that as a framework to discuss these other mm-hmm. movies. Mm-hmm. What was the vision of that film and what was your role in it? What happened to you in it that you put on screen?
Oh, well, it was a beautiful role because it's a, you know, he's a counterfeiter. He's an artist. He's also a criminal. That's all floating around inside this guy. And that's it.
The Holy Trinity.
Yeah. Where Billy Friedkin was at that moment, he had great successes. And recently, as he was rolling into that, he had had some not so great successes. And
Sorcerer,
I'm told, I don't know this because I was just a kid at the time, but that really set him back as far as his currency to get money and choose projects. So he was like, he was always kind of iconoclastic and always had a little chip, you know, in a nice way. And he was like, well, so damn it, I'm going to make a movie. Uh-huh. And he was determined to cast actors that nobody knew. In fact, I remember at the audition, he said, yeah, I'm interested because nobody knows you. I mean, nobody knows Billy. Nobody knows John, you know. They'll be able to enter the story better because they don't have any association outside of the story. There was a part of him that was very intellectual and very bright. That was another part of him that was like a street kid, you know? He wanted to get dirty, you know? He wanted to check out these worlds. And he entered this world of counterfeiters and criminals. It was great fun to shoot. Sometimes you'd show up and he'd say, oh, you know what? We're not going to do that today. We're going to do something else. On my way home, I found this fabulous location, and I thought we'd do a scene, and then he'd invent things. Mm. So he's very fluid, very inspired, a lot of fun, but also wild because he liked to jump off the bridge, you know, find his wings on the way down.
Did you like to jump off with him?
I tried, you know. I mean, his big instruction to me was, and I remember this so well, Zen, Will, Zen. And the truth is, then I knew nothing about Zen. Zen just meant simple to me.
What does it mean now?
Simple.
No. How did that fluidity that you're describing, how did that contrast with Oliver Stone on Platoon? Because he discovered
There was fluidity there too, because we were shooting in the jungle and you don't control things, you know, and we were doing an incredible amount of setups a day because Bob Richardson, you know, was very loose and very fast, and there was very little lighting or rehearsal. So much of it was going, drawing your equipment, putting on your uniform, no makeup, no trailers, nothing. We're in the jungle. And then they say, this is what we're doing. And we set it up and we do it. We play soldier, you know. We tried to learn how to do soldier things, which we did to some degree, but we did it with a terrific pressure to honor authenticity because we were working with people that had been there. And of course, Platoon was based on his personal experience, so you didn't want to distort or Hollywood up is this passion project of his.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we take a look? Here's you as Sergeant Elias in Oliver Stone's Platoon from 1986.
It's a beautiful night.
Yeah, I love this place at night. The stars. There's no right or wrong in them. You're just there.
That's a nice way of putting it. Barnes has got it in for you, doesn't he?
Barnes believes in what he's doing.
And you? You believe?
I'm 65. Yeah. Now. No. What happened today is just the beginning. We're going to lose this war.
Around this time, you gave this interview and you said, and I think it's instructive to how we talk about and understand the things you've done. You said, I have no obligation to be transformed into something that I'm not. It all remains me, in that it all remains my experience, my history. Sergeant Elias means nothing to me. Sergeant Elias was me during this period of time in the Philippines, under these ground rules. I think all characters live in you. You just frame them, give them circumstances, and that character will happen.
Wow. I'm still stuck in that.
Are you stuck in that, or is there a freedom in that?
No, there's freedom. Listen, the problem with talking about what you do is it's very imprecise. And you know, I like talking about it because it's imprecise and it's slippery and it moves around. And for every project, you've got to remake your process. Mm-hmm. It's slippery. So you say some stuff that's not true all the time because you're reaching for some little points of contact.
Of language.
You can work from that and jump off from that.
Well, how did you remake yourself in the films of Paul Schrader? You've made a handful of movies with him. I'm thinking about Light Sleeper, mm-hmm. most recently The Card Counter. Mm-hmm. When you think of him and those experiences, what comes to mind?
Well, I've worked a lot with Paul. He talks about, you know, he does a lot of his work in the writing. So when he casts, he kind of relies on you to come up with the goods. I remember in Light Sleeper.
Love that movie.
Yeah, it's so a good movie, I think. And it was an important movie to me because it's a very New York movie. And also, it's one of the few times where I felt like, if my life was different, I could be this guy. So it felt very close to me.
You felt that?
Yeah, I did. And also the research of it, because that was a period of, not me personally, but a lot of drug use in New York, because I play a white-collar drug dealer. I remember Paul, I thought, God, this guy doesn't talk to me. We do the shots. I like the script. I'm engaged. I'm doing things that I've learned how to do. It's interesting. New York is my town. I know it. I felt very comfortable, but at the same time, there was a little bit of insecurity about it. He didn't talk to me. And about 2 days after that thought was obsessing me, we're going up in an elevator, and he says, hey, Willem, I know I don't talk to you too much about what you're doing, but you're doing fine. So once again, he makes a world. He makes the world in the writing.
Right.
And they're usually fairly modest budgets that I've worked on with him, which gives you a certain discipline to not, just to do things essentially. It's a reasonable way to work. And because I know with time, we get a little bit of a shorthand and a lot of trust. But my experience has been much more, they do their work in making the world.
Right.
And you enter it, and they watch you enter it, and they watch you see and deal with the world, and then they have a response to that.
To go back to what you said about Schrader, mm-hmm. do you need to be liked by your director? Does it help you as a performer? Is that something you're often thinking about, the relationship between the two of you?
You know what? That's a good question. I would say not liked, but they have to be with you. Actually, I don't care in a funny way because I'm an extension of them. So I don't think about that. I'm not looking back at them saying, how am I doing? I'm looking forward to keep on going. It is about showing up and applying yourself. That's it. And you know whether that's happening or not. You don't need someone to say, you're doing good. Sometimes you get insecure, but even then, I think you gotta suck it up and keep on going. And it's their responsibility if what they're seeing doesn't fit into their world or is disturbing what they want to see, then they've got to come to you and make an adjustment. And that's fair. But the pleasure of committing yourself to this structured thing is what it's about. Mm-hmm. That's the pleasure. That's the positive energy. That's the thing that gets you going. To lose yourself in something. And when I say lose yourself, I mean be without petty concerns and really commit to doing something, accomplishing something. Mm.
Did you lose yourself on the Florida Project with Sean Baker?
I try to lose myself as much as I can. With the Florida Project, I tried to be a good hotel manager. That's it.
But the fluidity of that project, there was the first one you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, mm-hmm. and the collaborative ways in which everyone worked, the interplay between people, that in some ways the movie is about how happiness is interdependent on the people in and around you.
It's true.
And to me, it's somewhat of a metaphor for making movies or trying to do the work that you've made.
I'm with you.
I was watching Poor Things and I thought the warmth of your role here, the tenderness that's at the heart of Poor Things, I felt that deeply in the Florida Project as well. It reminded me of that film.
Well, he's a person that takes care. And that's always moving to me. I think the thing that moves me more than anything else in a movie is when someone extends themselves in a way that is, you know, has at least a flavor of selflessness to it. You know, that they're doing it because they need to do it. It's a natural thing. It's not transactional. They're doing it because it has to be done. And if everything that is made is some sort of expression of what our experience is being here and why we're doing here and tries to address itself to, you know, what we're here for, I think the one that I keep on coming up with, and this may sound a little sweet, but we're here for each other because that's what we got. Mm. What's beyond this world, we don't know. You can have some sense of it, but you don't know. We won't know until we get there. So while we're here, the best thing we can do is be useful.
I'm just going to sit with that for a moment. Mm. I'm touched.
And maybe it's delusional. I'm not saying I am. I'm talking about ambition.
Right.
The ambition of being useful. You know, why aren't I building schools in underserved communities? But I also have to give a disclaimer.
I agree.
A disclaimer because I see it in myself and I see it in other actors. You know, what sometimes is seen as a fairly pure in heart gets translated as an egocentric justification of celebration of self. It should have more contradiction and holes and funkiness to it.
I think we definitely have that in here.
Okay, good.
You are and have been, it seems to me, to every filmmaker you've worked with, a very willing vessel for the project. I mean, I have quote after quote from Oliver Stone, Scorsese, David Lynch, all of them say over and over and over again the same thing, which is that you come to the work on time without ego, and which it doesn't seem like you agree with entirely, but a willingness to do anything in service of the project.
I think that's true, because I think that's the only way to be free.
My last two questions. In doing that work where you feel most free, you said once, often when I finish a performance, I'm depressed for about 5 minutes afterwards, no matter how well it went, because it's never good enough. I don't know what the word is metaphysically. It's not good enough. You did this thing, it's gone. You're energized, but at the same time, it's gone. Whether they hated it doesn't matter because it's gone. If there is intensity or fury, I think it's because when a performance ends or a shot is cut, I die a little bit. I can't stand for things to end. So a performance is like a life that I flail angrily through until it's over.
Wow, I was really swinging for the fences there. When I hear that, it's common for a lot of performers, you know, after they perform, whether they're performing, it's not about the size of the venue or the reception. But after you've had that engagement that I keep on talking about, that kind of concentration, it's hard to have that in life. And when you return to life after being in this artificial, this structured situation, there's a little anxiety because in a performance, sometimes it's possible to connect the moments and connect the dots. It doesn't happen all the time, and when it does, it's special. But sometimes when you feel that, it's a kind of super being there that is difficult to find in life. That's all.
Almost impossible.
Almost impossible. But I think if you learn to have a taste for that, you can try to bring it to your life.
What do you mean by that?
Connecting the dots. Being present, not falling out, not being distracted, having a kind of concentration that is aware and considers 360. Isn't just about serving your drive to, I don't know, you know, the call and response of sense objects, you know, pleasure. I want this, you know. It's outside of that because you may adopt those kind of desires, those kind of motivations when you're performing in a fictional construct, but they don't run that deep, you know. They don't blind you the way that they do in life.
Right.
Because it's fictional. So in a funny way, you're freer because you're not playing for keeps. You're playing, you know.
Till the shot ends.
Nobody's betting.
I suppose the only thing we can end on is an example of me connecting the dots just one more time for
okay,
us.
Okay, do it.
You made a film about 10 years ago called Pasolini.
Yeah.
It's directed by Abel Ferreira. It played at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2014. Mm-hmm. I saw the film at that festival, and you and I sat down, much like we're doing now, except I was 20.
Yeah. It was like in a bar.
Uh-huh, it was in a bar.
I remember you from that time. I didn't connect that.
It was then.
You were good. You stuck in my mind. You were young, yeah, but you were happening, and you were turned on, so I like that.
I was interviewing Abel, and he said, Willem, come over here. This kid's fucking crazy.
But from Abel, that's like a compliment.
Yeah, I had to go to the therapist after that. But
good on you.
I took it as a compliment. And I looked up that interview this morning. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I asked you about was you're about to turn 60 pretty soon. How do you feel about that? You said, I feel like I'm still 22 years old. I'm young at heart. And you know, everything still goes. I don't know what that means. It's good getting old because you see the cycles. You see the rise and fall of things much easier. And also, I'm never bored. But this last line, this is what stuck with me at the end. He said, the only problem with getting older is everything goes faster. I guess as we leave, I thought, does that still feel true to you? And maybe more importantly,
except for the lie about feeling 22 years old.
What have you done about that? If that is true, does time still move faster?
Very fast, very fast. Yeah. And what that makes you do is it makes you look beyond. When you're young, you're trying to carve out your way in the world. When you've been around for a little while, you're trying to carve out your exit from the world, which hopefully won't happen for some time. But I just think it's natural as you get older and you see colleagues go away and you get, you know, further down the line. And, you know, I'm healthy. I'm working, finding some of the best opportunities of my life now. I'm not going to stop anytime soon. But I think naturally you start to look beyond.
And what do you see beyond?
You can see what's beyond in the world, and I think you start to look for it there. In the origin and the rise and fall of things, you know, is basically a spiritual impulse, I guess. It's to realize where you come from and where you're going to. The truth is, the second that we're born, we start to construct this character that we call ourselves, that a lot of our life we're just protecting. And I think that's what blocks us on a lot of things. And then after you see you win some, you lose some, you win some, you lose some, that's the rise and fall that I'm talking about. At the end, you're interested in returning to your relationship to everything. And that happens only when you're older, because it's useless when you're younger, because you gotta get there. You gotta make those mistakes and have those things happen to you to propel you to that place that is you, but you don't really want to go there until you're ready. And I'm not talking about death. I'm talking about some sense of self in a healthy way, not in a, you know, an accumulation of stuff way, not a thing of power, but in fact a release. Mm. But that gets all kind of dreamy. But you know what? It's at the core of so many things.
Of your work, I imagine?
Everything. What I have for lunch.
Well, I want to say that the mistakes that you mentioned, that you had to make to get to the place you're at now, to produce the things you have made that have meant a great deal to me,
right,
and to, I'm sure, many people listening. And the cycles that we keep talking about, the undulations, however you've navigated, I'm certainly glad that you have.
Well, thank you.
And I thank you for the time, as always.
Sure.
Willem Dafoe.
Okay.
Did we do it?
We did it.
Are you all right?
Yeah. What's not to be all right about?
Find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They could go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive bonus content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. Be sure to share the show on social media. You can tag us at TalkEasyPod. Doing this is still the best way for new listeners to find the program. I want to give a special thanks this week to the teams at Narrative PR and Searchlight, the Academy Library, and of course, our guest, Willem Dafoe. You can see him in the new film, Poor Things, which is now in limited release across the country. To find local show times and to get your tickets, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. If you want to hear other conversations with great actors, I'd recommend our talks with Rami Youssef, Tom Hanks, Ethan Hawke, and Oscar Isaac. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to purchase one of our mugs that come in cream or navy or our vinyl record with Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries. Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Kira Posey, Tara Machado, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Malcolm Gladwell, Greta Cohen, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to another episode of Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.